For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
So good morning.
Good morning.
And Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. With that in mind, I thought I'd talk today a little bit about light, since this is often called the season of light. And I like this season a lot. And growing up in a Christian context, I always loved this holiday beyond the goodies and the presents and the food. And there was something about the energy of the season that I always really liked and still do. And there's so much to this season that I think is so interesting, and it's so interesting that so many different traditions and cultures honor this season with a predominance of important rituals and ceremonies and holidays. Something that just struck me recently about it was sort of the paradox, how we call this the season of light, and we celebrate light, and yet it happens to also, of course, coincide with the winter solstice, and that's the shortest day of the year. It's the maybe we could call it the darkest day of the year. And actually, this December 25th day that's marked, you know, most obviously by Christmas, was originally the day. December 25th in the Julian calendar was the day in the pre-Christian era that the Romans celebrated solstice. So they marked the day a couple days later. I don't know if that was a mistake in their calculations, or if the Mayans, who were great calendar keepers and masters, they, and still are, they often will acknowledge a kind of lag like this of a few days in a calculation where the effect is actually felt. So maybe that's partly built into our traditions too, that we're experiencing this lag. But there's this paradox in celebrating light, or seeming paradox in celebrating light at this darkest time of the year. And it's interesting that also another part of this paradox is that this darkest time of the year is actually only the beginning of the dark time of the year. Even though the shortest day falls on December 21st, it's only the beginning of entering this dark season. So it seems only right that we, at this time of the year, think about and celebrate light. You know, like so many things, maybe we only really appreciate it as it sort of is leaving us or departing from us. Seems like there's a Zen aspect to this paradox, I think, of the season of light. And of course, you know, the day is called Christmas, Christ Mass. And we celebrate, or Christians celebrate, this birth of a Savior who is often described as this bringer of light. I was sort of thinking about this talk. I was doing a little research, and it seems to be mainly in the book of John in the New Testament that Jesus Christ described himself often as a light in the world. That's where that phrase crops up a lot. I've come as a light in the world. But interestingly, in December, we also celebrate the enlightenment of the Buddha. And the Buddha was often described that way too. Particularly as the tradition developed into the Mahayana tradition, but before it really moved into East Asia, China and Japan, Korea, etc. Some of these early sutras, these early Mahayana sutras that are still so influential in many of our traditions, talk about Buddha in terms of light. So, of course, the most prevalent of and most obvious example would be these Pure Land schools that venerate, in particular, Amida Buddha. So Amida is a bit of a conjunction for two Buddha's names, Amitabha and Amitayus. Amitayus means infinite life, the Buddha of infinite life. And Amitabha is the Buddha of infinite light. So kind of conjuncting those in... it became Amitabha, or just Amida, I should say. So in China, Amitofo. In Japan, Amida. In Korea, also, Amita. So... So the Lotus Sutra is perhaps the most influential and most venerated text in all of East Asia. But it has its source in India in the early days of the Mahayana tradition. So there's just, you know, infinite references to light in that text. And I just thought I'd share a couple of them from that and another text or two. Some of these early images of light. So the Buddha emitted a light from between his eyebrows, manifesting signs that are rarely seen. This light illumined the eastern direction, 18,000 Buddha lands. One could see how these Buddha lands, adorned with numerous jewels, shone with hues of lapis lazuli and crystals, was due to the illumination of Buddha's light. And here's another one. The Buddha of immeasurable life has 84,000 features. Each feature has, 84,000 secondary attributes. Each secondary attribute sends forth 84,000 rays of light. Each ray of light shines out over the world of the 10 quarters. And those sentient beings who are mindful of the Buddha are embraced by that light, never to be abandoned. So these sutras, unlike the early Buddha sutras, which were presumably, supposedly, allegedly, historically based from his talks, where he talks about light some as well, but these are these kind of fantastical samadhi documents that really, in reading them, they evoke this sort of poetic flavor, very fantastical. Just infinite, brilliant Buddha verses, right? Full of light and jewels and shimmering and radiant. That's just the quality of reading these sutras. And another one of these would be the Avatamsaka Sutra, or the Flower Ornament Sutra, which is, in English translation, I don't know, 1,500, 1,600 pages long. There's a few more of these sort of light passages I thought I'd share today. The Buddha's great light of knowledge illumines all lands in 10 directions. The Buddha body is peerless. It has no compare. Its light shines throughout 10 directions, traversing all realms of existence for countless ages. His light is everywhere, as pure as space. Emanating inconceivable nets of lights everywhere, purifying all conscious beings. All the light in the world cannot match the light of a single pore of the Buddha. This is how inconceivable the Buddha light is. The great ocean of worlds has no bounds. Its circumference of jewels is pure and multicolored. Made of masses of diamonds, also raining beautiful jewels, their jewel atmospheres are unique and different, radiating pure light, beautifying everywhere. Buddha emanates a great light. That light touches all with its glow, pervading the whole cosmos, illuminating the world with light that has no end. Behold the Buddha's body with webs of light so pure, filling the 10 directions. It goes on and on. I mean, we could read hundreds of these descriptions in these texts. And, you know, reading these books as works of sort of mystical literature, I don't think they demand or even ask that we analyze them rationally. I think even, I don't know about you, but even just reading those phrases, it's kind of wonderful. I mean, you do feel sort of bathed in the light. I mean, Buddha's name itself came from him being perceived as radiant. And upon being asked why he was so radiant, he just said, "I'm awake. I am Buddha." And therefore he became known as the Buddha. So there's that quality to it. But and one last thing I wanted to say about this was recently I saw a PBS show about string theory. Has anybody seen that? I think it was on Nova. And of course, metaphysicians, mystics have forever stated explicitly that we are light. That all of nature is light in some manifestation. But even physicists now, they said explicitly, for instance, in this show, that we are light and we are energy vibrating. And this manifest world that we see around us is just a very dense, low vibration of light. Really, you know, this is straight up Theosophical Society type stuff, right? I mean, they said the same thing. It's just so fascinating that science now is explicitly saying these things that, you know, of course have been understood in other contexts, in other ways. So what I wanted to do was sort of lay out this kind of light, Buddhist light background, but then discuss a little bit what happens in the Zen tradition, as the Zen tradition forms, as these traditions move into China. Something very interesting happens. It's a very different flavor talking about light. And the great metaphor for light in the tradition shifts sort of from being the sun, kind of a solar image, which is also very much in the Christian tradition, I think. It's a very solar image of light. Radiant, bright, luminous, warm. But, of course, the great metaphor in the Zen tradition, this sort of embodiment, the great metaphoric embodiment of the entire tradition, is the moon. It's the light of the moon. Another interesting coincidence for this talk today, or for our season, is that the new moon was last night. So I just think that's really interesting. The whole flavor of Zen is colored by moonlight more than, I would say, sunlight. Of course, these distinctions are somewhat provisional, if not arbitrary, but provisional. So, you know, we could just stop at that and just say, what's the difference between sunlight and moonlight? There's a wonderful sort of koan that one can just sort of live within. But why? You know, why did our Zen tradition, why does it seem to emphasize moonlight? What is the quality of moonlight? What is the quality of that sort of light? And There's something I like very much about that. I think part of it is stemming from Zen's being influenced by or its roots in what we now call the Taoist traditions. So kind of moving beyond these radical psychedelic Mahayana sutras, I thought I'd leaven that with the first chapter in the Tao Te Ching, which is of course the great source text for that stream in Chinese philosophy and thought, religious thought. The Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. This is the translation by Stephen Mitchell, who is a Zen student of many years, a Zen monk for a certain time. The unnameable is the eternally real. Naming is the origin of all particular things. Free from desire, you realize the mystery. Caught in desire, you see only the manifestations. Yet mystery and manifestations arise from the same source. This source is called darkness. Darkness within darkness, the gateway to all understanding. So this is really corrective and I think helpful and almost stands alone in a lot of ways. If we think about the Western traditions out of which Christianity is, in our culture, the most prevalent manifestation, but I think in all the monotheistic traditions, the Abrahamic traditions and others, they're profoundly dualistic. Maybe this is stemming from earlier traditions, Zoroastrianism or something like that. I don't know. I'm not a scholar of these things, but there's this profound dualistic setup, right? Light versus darkness, good versus evil, righteousness versus the unrighteous. I don't know. We see the manifestations of this dualism playing out in some profoundly negative ways in our culture. And that's a big discussion that could go on for a while, but I think that this is so profound that the first utterance of this great text emphasizes mystery and darkness. Mystery and darkness. So I think that flavor was incorporated into this tradition of Dharma that came to be known as Zen. And there are infinite references to the moon and moonlight in our Zen tradition, and of course lots of artwork. Maybe you're familiar with lots of paintings of the moon, ink paintings of the moon. Great poems, of course, like Ryokan, the great Soto monk, who was often just gobsmacked by the moon and would spend endless hours gazing at the moon and praising the moon. And it's just infinite throughout the Chinese, Japanese, Korean traditions. These East Asian traditions, the appreciation of the moon. I'm going to read it from a couple of Dogen references to light and moonlight from the Eihei Kodoku, Dogen's extensive record that our teacher Taigen translated with Shohaku Okumura. I'll start with one, it's Dharma Halt Discourse 393. Excuse me, I've had a cold lately. I'm recovering from. And I think this one sort of embodies this Taoist flavor a little bit too. You kind of sense it here. He says, "We surely have the opportunity to encounter the family style of the Buddha ancestors. Black lacquer emits light unlimited by inside or outside. further observing, the mountains in four directions turn blue or yellow. The reeds on the grass roof hut grow old, and I cover it with firewood. Although the moon descends and colors the window, we should take care that refined beauty not turn into shiny trinkets. So there's a lot of nice images there, but I guess the one I'll touch on is that I think is particularly poignant and important for us at this time in our culture. Although the moon descends and colors the window, we should take care that refined beauty not turn into shiny trinkets. So I think that's kind of happened to this celebration of light in the midst of darkness in our culture. It's kind of turned into more of an obsession with shiny trinkets. Yeah. So this is a risk in our Zen practice too. Shiny trinkets can take on other forms, not necessarily, you know, electronic gadgets or jewelry or, you know, any of those kind of commercial manifestations, but it can become states of mind, robes, Buddha statues, what have you. But he points out that refined beauty, I mean, he's still prioritizing this idea of beauty and refinement, refining something. What that refining is, I mean, that's another koan for us, I guess. But I also like the image of black lacquer emits light, unlimited by inside or out. It's the kind of that darkness within darkness, this sort of luminous blackness, luminous darkness that the Taoist traditions kind of speak about, rather than necessarily this solar image, this radiant blast. Sometimes I think maybe we expect, and sometimes we experience in our meditation, very luminous kind of qualities. But often we experience it's the reverse of that. Maybe what feels like darkness or sludginess or something like that. And Dogen speaks about this too. And our Zen traditions speak about this. Let me go ahead and I'll just jump to a passage where he talks about it. This is a little bit of a longer one. I'll just go ahead and read the whole thing. This was very near the end of his life. It was given in 1252, so that was, I think, the year he passed away. The moon is neither round nor lacking. How could it wax or wane? Even if it is good for offering, when we pause our restrictions, it is good for practice. Second moon of Xuansha is about to set. Yunyan's "which is this moon" does not flourish. Taigen was talking about that koan recently, "which is this moon," holding up the broom. Maybe you were here for that. I'm not going to go into it too much here, but although this is so, for descendants of the Buddha ancestors, there is also the matter of going beyond. All right, that's the setup. And then he conveys this very interesting myth that I think is really cool. When the world-honored one was in the world, the Asura king Rahula wanted to swallow the moon. The heavenly moon was frightened and appeared before Buddha and recited to Buddha this verse. It's a very interesting image, wanted to swallow the moon. Maybe there's a part of us too, even in our Zen practice, we want to swallow the moon. And we'll see what happens to Rahula when he tries to swallow the moon. So world-honored Buddha of great wisdom and pure effort, now I take refuge and make prostrations. This Rahula is upsetting me. I entreat the Buddha to look upon me with pity and help and protect me. This is the Asura king. speaking. The Buddha recited a verse to the Asura king, Rahula, saying, "The moon can illuminate the darkness pure and cool. This is the great bright lamp in the empty sky. Its color is white and pure with 1,000 rays. Do not swallow the moon, but immediately release it." At this time, the Asura king Rahula sweat with fear and shame, immediately letting go of the moon. Seeing that the Asura king Rahula was scared into releasing the moon, the Asura king Vadisa gave a verse asking, "Why did you, Rahula, shiver with fear and immediately release the moon with your whole body sweating as if you were sick and your mind agitated with fear?" And the Asura king Rahula gave this verse in answer. "The world-honored one gave a verse ordering that if I did not release the moon, my head would be split into 7 pieces. Even if I kept my life, there would be no peace. Therefore, I now have released this moon." The Asura king Vadisa in verse said, "Buddha is difficult to encounter. He appears in the world only after a very long time. When he expounded this pure verse, Rahula promptly released the moon." So Dogen goes on to say, "Therefore now the moon in the sky has maintained its lifespan through 500 heavenly years simply to requite the world-honored one's help and protection. The lifespan of that heaven is such that 50 years of human life is like one day and night in that heavenly time span." He goes on to describe how much time that is. It's a lot of time. "Cloud and water monks, you should know that today the autumn moon is radiant, pure, and cool, illuminating the darkness in the world, just as does the world-honored one's eyes in their conditioned capacity. On this very occasion of the autumn full moon," even though we're having a new moon, a winter new moon, "I, Ehe, wish to raise up the world, the word brightness expounded by the world-honored one in his verse, to increase the radiance of the moon palace and illuminate the darkness of delusion in the great thousands of worlds. This must be the transmission of the lamp and the command of Buddha. Because of Buddha's majestic power, the palace is bright. 1,000 glorious rays appear at once. Even if humans love the moon in mid-autumn, the brightness of the half-moon is boundless in the heavens." So there's a lot there. I could just be talking about this one talk, but maybe the most important line is the last one: "The brightness of the half moon is boundless in the heavens." So we could also say the brightness of the new moon is boundless in the heavens. And of course, the new moon, we don't see any light at all. Just like at this time of year, it's maybe the darkest, the shortest days, the most darkness. And yet, this radiance of the Buddha, is not diminished. And yet, in our Zen tradition, it's not enough to say that it's not just diminished. To say that the light is still full, or the light is still complete, or the light is still shining brightly, is only half true. We don't want to prioritize light over dark. We have to embody in our practice this appreciation, I think, for all of these seasons, for all of these realities of light, for all of these realities that we experience in our practice. So we don't always in our lives experience pure radiance, or what we might think is pure radiance of Buddha light, right? Maybe we very rarely experience that. And yet, there's this intimation, there's this intuition, there's this faith that brings us out on a day like today when, you know, we could be somewhere else doing something else with other people. I have family and from out of town, and my wife is cooking blueberry pancake breakfast this morning. I could be home doing that, I suppose. But I would rather be here. Something in me responds to this call to manifest this practice. And it makes me think of the years that I spent living in a residential, rural residential center, a monastery of sorts, in California. And every morning we'd get up at 4 o'clock, and it would be mine or someone else's responsibility to light all the kerosene lamps. Our zendo was an old, converted, 100-year-old, 150-year-old barn. And it didn't have electric light. And so we would light the kerosene lamps and the candles. And once I got moving and was out of bed, I liked it every day. But I often was aware of it feeling like Christmas. It felt like Christmas every day, the days that I experienced that. But it would happen throughout the year. And it was a celebration of light in the darkness, I guess. And that's what our Zazen practice is. It's really, we light ourselves like a candle. And we don't just come to it seeking. And in fact, I think more importantly, we come to it expressing. And I think this is, what our tradition speaks about a lot, especially the Soto tradition. I love how explicit it is that, practice itself is enlightenment. It is lighting the candle. It is bringing light into the darkness of our own anger and greed and ignorance. We engage in this practice, and even in the midst of that, this darkness that we experience in ourselves every day, at least I do, I get angry every day, and I do something ignorant every day, and I'm greedy every day, and yet if I bring myself to my cushion, I can experience the light within that, right within the midst of these conditions that maybe seem dark. Personally, I can't imagine my life without some way to make that connection. And I don't know how other people do it if they don't have that. I suppose we all do in our ways, but I'm very grateful to Zazen and to this Zen tradition to help me to connect with light on a daily basis and not just have to wait for a ceremony or a holiday. And wait for somebody else to show up and light the candle. I can do it myself. I like that very much. But that light that gets lit, I don't want to overemphasize the self aspect. I like in the Japanese tradition how there's this distinction between self-power and other power in different traditions. Amida Buddha, trusting in Amida Buddha, this Buddha of light, that's often described as other power. And Zen is often described as self-power. You're lighting the candle for yourself. You're enlightening yourself through your own effort. But again, in our Soto tradition, I think these distinctions collapse, as they do in all traditions at certain levels, that we do experience the grace of Buddha's light through exerting ourselves a little bit, through sitting down on our cushions and arranging ourselves elegantly, refining ourselves, and experiencing this light, and not a light that we necessarily see with our eyes, but we just have an intuition about it, an intimation about it. All right, that's all I've got. That's enough. Thanks, guys. Does anybody have any comments? Questions? Yeah.
I'm really struck by the images of the moon and the black lacquer because they're reflective light.
Right, right.
Both reflections, and we use the word reflection.
Right.
When we're looking inward and thinking. Thich Nhat Hanh also uses the idea of awareness as a mirror.
Of course, mirror in Zen's, to the root of the tradition.
It's all a reflection.
Yeah.
It's not a burning light like the sun.
Right.
But a reflected light. And that's what we do. Reflect.
We turn the light around, and there's all these other images I wanted to stay, have been floating around in my head, and of course that image of even the Japanese having parties to look at water reflected in water, or the moon reflected in water, and as you said, the etymology of it, that serene reflection, silent illumination, these words that come in our tradition, turning around the light to shine within. It's really interesting.
Thank you. That was a wonderful talk. I love that you ask what's the difference between sunlight and moonlight. My Japanese name is Domio, which is earthlight. So I'd add that third.
Absolutely, I love that. That's awesome.
And so now I think I have to go write it on the earthlight.
Yeah.
That's my colon. Thank you.
I love that. Earthlight. Yeah, how many kinds of light, There are many kinds of light. But moonlight, sunlight, and earthlight. That's radical.
I don't know where to go with this. But sort of playing with these images of light and so on, and you were talking about this thing you'd seen about string theory, and I'm never much in a position to use those sort of scientific images to sort of go back and forth in the way that many people do. But in your talk, it occurred to me that something about beings experience light differently, the sort of range and spectrum that we're responsive to is specific to us, specific to our species, and may be very different for others. And as you were indicating, your appreciation of that show, this idea, but it turns out it's all light. And I think that there's, that maybe somewhere buried in all this is this image of this sort of appreciation that the little band that we have that's so brightly illuminated is actually, just part of this much bigger thing that we can't approach, directly. It's not within our sort of perceptual and conceptual apparatus to appreciate it directly, but you have, you can develop this sense of that being, part of, nice word, a continuum, that something that's, much broader and that supports that. I don't know where to go with that, but I was thinking, we were referring to that show too, this idea of this becoming more and more common. It's probably the most sort of groundbreaking kind of thing to come out of the physical or astrophysical kinds of sciences in recent years, this idea of dark energy, this idea that
dark matter,
there's something out there and we can't illuminate it.
And it's actually like 90% of the universe is actually dark matter. I think that...
I don't know how to play with those images, but...
Well, I think that, these early Mahayana sutras, they do this. They do the same thing that I think modern physics and astronomy can do for us, which is just blow our minds, They do it. It just starts... with the Buddha talking on Vulture's Peak, and suddenly, you know, his long tongue rolls out for billions of miles and 10 billion other Buddhas appear and they're speaking to billions of other... Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, your mind is immediately just put in its measly little context, you know? And I think that the sciences do this too, but somehow they don't allow as much, I don't know, something keeps contained. I guess it's rationality. It's still kind of contained. But I think so much of, you know, what the mystery that the Tao Te Ching talks about is that sense of wonder that we want to tap into and experience. And at the same time, though, bring it into our life, you know, so that we're not just, you know, tripping out, but how do we, you know, how do we bring it into practice? Or contain it, not even do anything with it, but just to hold it. You know, maybe that gets back to that reflected image, like water and the moon, or like a mirror that reflects clearly, you know, what it's seeing. So I'm just riffing off of your ideas too, but... I guess the other thing that comes to mind too is that last Dogen image about, even though we only see a small band of the spectrum, that small band of the spectrum is the whole moon.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a complete expression.
Right. It's a complete expression. Yeah. That's the thing that we keep waking up to. Hopefully. Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah.
References to the complexity of light and dark, and they aren't, there's this big split in thinking about it. Because I think within the seeds of light there's dark, and within the dark there's the seeds of light. And could we even know one without the other? Could we know light if we didn't have experience of dark?
Well, that's a good, it makes me think of another point, another image that was coming up for me, that very famous line from Genja Koan, when one side is illuminated, the other side is dark. And then, of course, there's the Tai Chi symbol. We call it the yin-yang symbol oftentimes, but it's called the Tai Chi, the supreme ultimate symbol of reality, which is the yin-yang, you know, where the out of the darkness the light appears, out of the light the darkness appears. And but it's important to acknowledge or realize, yeah, that when one side's illuminated, still another side's dark. So we don't get to see the whole picture. You know, I think we suffer under this this delusion. And delusion is such a strong word, kind of misused. But we think there's this idea, you know, historically throughout all the stories, there's this idea that, and I think it's still kicking around very much in our American Dharmic context, that enlightenment, somehow you get enlightened and you are full of light and you see light and everything's illuminated. And sometimes you can have experiences in your zazen that sort of feel like that a little bit. where everything sort of just opens up, maybe becomes really clear. But, you know, nobody lives there. We can't. We can't. Not in this body, you know, because we're at the lowest wavelength, right? That's where we live. So I think that's some wonderful quality in the Zen practice, that all these different qualities of darkness and light, that spectrum, in each moment, if experienced completely, is the whole moon, even if it's dark. Yeah. So, yeah, thanks for mentioning that. It made me remember that great Dogen line. I wanted to get in there.
Yeah. There's another line, I think it's in the Sambokai, something like, in the light there is darkness, you
right.
do not see it as darkness. In
right.
the darkness there's light, you do not see it as light.
Yeah, that's great.
I've never really thought much about the shift that you identified between the sort of image of the sun and the image of the moon, but it sort of occurs to me that one of the things about moonlight, as you were pointing out, it's reflective. I mean, there's this idea, you know, the image of of the sun, the sort of brilliant, simultaneous, direct illumination of everything. Whereas the moon is reflected, you know, it ebbs and flows. It occurs in the context of darkness. It's always sort of partial. And that's actually, in a way, closer to, I presume, the experience of most of us. I mean, you know, there's always the illumination or whatever is complete in and of itself as it is, but it's always partial. It's always shifting. And you're right, there's this sort of like lingering notion of what waking up is, and it's the sort of place in the back of our mind is this idea like, well, I'm just going to get the whole works, and you know, maybe for some people somewhere. But.
Yeah. Another image that came to mind is there's a collection of Taizan Maizumi Roshi's teachings called the Hazy Moon of Enlightenment. So it's not even the bright, big, full moon, you know, illuminating the sky, but it's like, it's hazy, it's partial. You could even call it the Hazy Crescent Moon of Enlightenment. You know, it's just a sliver. But yeah, I mean, that point about it just, you know, the moon is in constant transformation. It's never still. And yet it's the stillest thing, right? It's so still. The night, think of the moon at night. It's a feeling of stillness. And yet the moon is in quite relatively rapid seeming transformation. I like that word, scudding. Scudding clouds. We imagine the moon with scudding clouds. It seems like clouds are moving quickly at night and obscuring and revealing. And that's our Zen practice, yeah. Thanks, Eric. Well, I think that's good. Why don't we go have some tea and cookies? We're going to dispense with temple cleaning today. So thank you very much.